Okay, today I'm going to talk about these brain tilings. I review the basic tools we need, then I will talk about a little bit about the arc charges and their relations to the tilings. And then I'm going to talk about a special embedding of the tiling, a special deformed embedding, which is called the isoradial embedding. And then eventually I will talk about the fast inverse algorithm, which constructs the brain tilings from the toric diagrams. Okay, so what do we have? So this is the usual ADS CFT setup. The CFT is described by quivers. Just one example, the Apezzo 1 or the Apezzo 8, depending on whether you're a mathematician or physicist. The Apezzo 7, 8, I don't know. Okay, so this is it. Here the nodes are SUM gauge groups, and the arrows label bifundamental fields. And you also need to specify the superpotential for these unequal one theories. Okay, so the ADS side is, this is the CFT. The gravity side is, should I draw this diagram? Here you have some flat four-dimensional space filled by D3 brains, and here you have a non-compact KVL, which has a base. This is some Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and this is a KVL threefold. So this is a cone. Okay, we are going to look at theories or backgrounds where these KVLs are toric manifolds, so we can use the powerful toric geometry. So how does toric geometry work? You start with a set of vectors in an integer lattice, and this lattice is three-dimensional. And the endpoints of these vectors are coplanar thanks to the Calabi-Yau condition, so that the canonical class is trivial. And then you can take this plane, this where these endpoints are coplanar, and then draw these so-called toric diagrams. So these are the endpoints of these vectors, and this, for example, is an example where this KVL is just C3. Okay, this is the conifold. And okay, I'm not going to do many more examples. I believe this is Y3-1.
Y3-1.
Cool. Okay, now an immediate question. What is the connection between the CFT and the gravity dual for which we drew these toric diagrams? There were many algorithms. Recently there was, to construct the theory, the quiver theory, there was this partial resolution technique, this inverse algorithm where you embed this in some orbifold, then you start making these partial resolutions, and then finally you get to the desired theory. You can also use exceptional collections to find the quiver. Recent developments allow us to go from the quiver to the toric diagram, and these are the brain tilings. So what are these brain tilings? Just a quick review. So we need a bipartite graph. Let's see. Bipartite means that all the faces have an even number of edges, so then we can color the nodes by two colors, black and white. This way. Okay, the graph, the dual of this graph is just a periodic weaver. So maybe I should draw this. So here the faces are the gauge groups, whereas in the quiver the nodes are the groups. So these placards in the quiver give you the terms in the superpotential. So we see that in the tiling, the nodes label the superpotential terms. Okay. So the tiling encodes both the quiver and the superpotential. This is why we like it. And then we can use the Castellan matrix and its determinant to compute the determinant, to compute a polynomial in two variables whose Newton polygon is just the toric diagram. Okay. So this we knew from Tolkovan. Okay, so what about the inverse process from the toric diagram to the brain tilings? So as you see here, because we take the determinant, we are losing information, which is very bad. So to resolve this problem, we have to make a detour and talk a little bit about R charges. So these are, for our purposes, these are numbers assigned to the bifundamental fields in the quiver, and they satisfy some constraints. For example, in the tiling language, because the superpotential has R charge 2, around the node, the sum of R charges is just 2. So this is around each node. We have such an equation for every node, and we also have for the gauge couplings for the beta functions another equation which says the beta function must vanish, and here this sum is over the edges or the corresponding R charges around the face. So basically around for this group. Okay, so we have these two equations, but do we really see what these equations mean? Anybody?
Some kind of weighting on the original tiling combined with the potential derivation or something? Like
a graph color? Okay, what I do is I multiply this and the NSVZ, the numerator of the NSVZ beta function by pi. So why do I do this? Because, what do we get? Okay, let's stare at this equation. If we could regard this as some angle, this ri times pi, where we are summing up such angles around the node, then from high school we know that, yes, they indeed sum up to 2 pi. So it's promising. What does the other equation mean? Okay, so here I have to reorder this equation. So for a face, r times pi equals 2. So from this 1, around the face, we get just the number of edges. This 2 becomes a minus 2, and there was a multiplication by pi. And we also know this formula from high school, because this is somehow just the sum of these internal angles for a polygon that has this many edges. Okay, what are these angles? Anybody? We have to realize these angles somehow in the tiling to really understand these two equations.
So for the hexagon, we have four parts. Which is the sum of angles of the hexagon.
Yeah. Okay, so what is the answer? The answer is, of course, you can deform the brain tiling as you wish. This is only a graph for us. So far, it was only a graph. So you have to embed this brain tiling in the plane in a very special way. And this embedding is called the isoradial embedding. So let's see an example. It's four squares. And this isoradial embedding means that all of the faces in the tiling can be inscribed in a circumcircle, so which has radius 1. Okay, so these circles must have the same unit radius, radii. Such an embedding typically exists.
Even when you have different kinds of, and you have mix like here, hexagons and
yeah.
Squares.
And I mean, you can deform the graph, you can move each node wherever you want. So. In fact, these equations will tell you that such an embedding exists. So, if you have a consistent theory and you don't have negative R charges or something. Zero R charges.
But it's not unique.
Yeah.
So these equations also, in some context, gave you the thing that they hold, gave you the condition that it was planar. Right?
Yeah. Right. If you sum up those equations in a special way, then you get the Euler characteristics.
Right, but this is stronger than just being planar. Right?
Yeah, this is much stronger because here you are using all of the equations, not just a single one, which you got from the sum.
What is the modular space of such embeddings?
We will talk about that. We will talk about that.
Is there an interpretation in terms of the minimization of the energy for brain configuration?
Not yet.
Can this be understood in terms of circle packing?
Instead of
taking the squares inside the circle and circles inside the square, you can make it'd be equivalent statement essentially, and then it'd turn into a.
Yeah, but for the squares, but if you have hexagons, then.
They don't have to be, I mean, you can still describe a circle and a hexagon.
Yeah, that's right.
So then it'd sort of be like the dual circle packing, but then you could describe it in terms of the circle packing problem, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Sure, well.
Is it clear that you can bound circle by the hexagon? Or?
Not sure. I think it was a right
hexagon,
sure.
Yeah, but if it's not, the sizes will be different because our charges will be different. So it's not clear that.
But you couldn't even describe it then. I guess that imposes some constraints on what it should look like.
Okay, here I'm talking about physics. So let me continue. We don't stop here. Of course, we still can't see the R charges. So we need to draw more lines. Fortunately, we have these colored chalks. So I actually drew each of these radii. So these red lines, these have a length 1. Unit lengths. Okay, this will be enough. So when we draw these lines, we get this red rhombus tiling. And now we can identify the R charges. So we see that for each bifundamental edge, there is one rhombus. So here, this is the rhombus. Here is the tiling edge. This is the rhombus. Maybe I should also. Yes. And the R charge times pi for this bifundamental will be this angle. So this one, which is the same as this one. And now we see that we doubled basically these angles, so they appear also here and here. So the sum around the node will be indeed 2 pi, where these the R charges that end whose bifundamentals end in this node will contribute to this sum. And what about the other equation? So if you have a polygon like this square here, then here the internal angles will meet up of these half angles, so this one. But there will be also the same half angle here. So again, this equation will be satisfied.
The pink lines
are just, so these circles have a center, and we connect the tiling nodes with these centers. So these are unit lengths.
Since you were saying that you are discussing physics now, so
yeah.
why do you know?
Because then you can identify the R charges as the angles of this rhombi. But this is a detour, as I said. This is just a motivation. And if you think about these brain tilings as, I don't know, Neville Schwartz brains, then. Okay, so let me continue. You still have to do a maximization. So of course this doesn't fix all the R charges. There is some moduli space of this, what Sergio mentioned, of this rhombus tiling, which is this red rhombus lattice here. So how can you deform this rhombus lattice? So let me. Let's say this is your rhombus lattice for the moment, and then you can deform it. Like this. You can tilt the lattice along such a so-called rhombus loop.
Is that
this is a, I would call it a baryonic U1, which is mixing with the R charge.
Can you give an example?
I mean this.
Given,
I mean, yeah. So if you, I mean, you can, so this is an example. If this is some orbifold of the conifold, then it's because the fundamental cell also changes a little bit, so I don't really want to be more exact here, but one can check this. So the tiling can be deformed along such a rhombus loop. So what is a rhombus loop? This is you start with a rhombus, and then you go to the next one, and to the next one you never turn. So you see that there will be one parallel edge always in the rhombus loop. So why is this important? Because what happens, I don't know, if you draw down a tiling, what happens if this rhombus loop, which I draw schematically like this, white line crosses itself. So what happens in such a case? Well, okay, anybody? Just imagine that you drew this rhombus lattice and then you go along such a rhombus loop. Yeah, it can be periodic, but inside the fundamental cell, you can draw any tiling. So if this is some big theory with a lot of SUNs, then you can draw basically anything. It must be periodic, but the periodicity may happen, you know, far away. So when you get such a thing, then of course at the intersection, because there is an intersection, at each intersection you have one single rhombus.
Actually, I didn't understand what it is that is intersecting. So what is that one?
So imagine that you take this path, and somehow it comes back to itself in some way, which it was the wrong. Should connect. It has nothing to do with periodicity.
I think an example would be how can you come back to you?
So, this is a torus, but let's see. Let's say that the fundamental cell is this big. So, you are. Basically, you don't care about the toricity.
Then the white line is not a straight line, I'm not going clear. So what are the rules?
Yeah, I mean also here the white line, which is just a schematic, the line for this rhombus loop here. I mean it's not a straight line at all.
It's because you did this thing that you go back.
Yeah, but I mean, in a priori, these rhombi don't have all the same angles, which is the theory that doesn't have equal arc charges. I mean, if the arc charges are different, then these rhombus angles will be different because they are just the same. And then these rhombi won't be all the same. So you get such things.
And I guess the doubt is that, are these always going to be some rhombi like that, or they can...
They are going to be rhombi because we made this isoradial embedding. Mm-hmm. So these are radii here. These are of unit lengths.
So you say you draw and this line crossing always the opposite edge, and if they don't all have the same size, it could be that you are curving.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, I don't really want to draw an example because the simplest example is just too complicated.
Okay, but
just a Gedanken experiment, what happens in such a case? So, because we have these parallel edges, these are all parallel, so we see that this is parallel this to this one.
Parallel, good word.
Yeah. And this is indeed true, because it means then that this rhombus becomes degenerate, which means that the corresponding angle becomes zero, which means that the corresponding R charge is zero, and which means that the theory is inconsistent. So this...
those opposite sides really are parallel.
Yeah.
So how did you manage to get...
So you have to collapse these rhombi. So then, of course, I drew this in a non-degenerate way. I mean, but if you draw this, then you will get something bad.
But I'm trying to say that if you have, I mean, that the theory with this is not good, so you shouldn't have that.
What I say is that if you have the tiling and you construct these, you don't need to actually draw this isoradially. You just draw these. Rhombi, which are not rhombi, these are just quadrilaterals. And then you find such a path, then you know that your theory you started with was inconsistent. Because, why? Because then these equations, which are the same as this trick with the rhombi, these will force one of the R charges to be zero. It is just the same. So those equations are just the same as these tricks with the rhombi.
You're trying to prove that this picture doesn't exist, right?
It can exist. I mean, if you have F0 and you dehiks it in a delicate way, then such a path will be there.
It does not exist in a consistent theory.
But in a consistent theory, it does not exist.
Because the effect is zero,
because then you will get, from such a path, you will get a degenerate rhombus whose angle is vanishing, which is just the same as the R charge, and that R charge is zero.
And this violates the bound coming from superconformal algebra.
So what we've done here is we gave a constraint on consistent tilings. So far we believed in that you, when you draw down a tiling, then you get a consistent theory or you get something. But now we have at least one constraint that such self-intersecting rhombus loops cannot exist. So maybe I should write, this is a rhombus loop.
So when you apply the bound, so you're talking about a unitary bound.
Right.
Are you talking about a gauge invariant operator or?
Yes.
So which gauge operator?
So for every given chiral model, conform a divariant.
Okay.
And the R charge of that divariant will be n times its R charge.
So
it can be anything but zero. Because the bound is, you have to be greater than the vertical.
Yeah,
so it's not allowed to be zero.
It is to, in a service thing, the anomalous dimension has to be positive. That's all. If you were imposing that it's greater than one.
You can have anomalous dimension be negative, for example, in the Clermont-Witter. Anomalous dimension is minus a quarter.
Okay. Okay, I'm talking about that. Non-gamma.
Oh, the scaling dimension for a gauge invariant operator has to be greater than one. It will be smaller than one. If it's smaller than one, you violate the violating the Bebye's condition.
Right, but what I understand is that is the condition that we're talking about here. Just you translated that into a condition for our charge.
Right, and so for our charge, it will be greater than 2/3.
Okay.
Now, if a chiral multiplet will have R charge zero, then a focus group will also have R charge zero.
Right.
And that varies. That's gauge invariant, and that varies.
Right, but you're looking. All I'm saying is that you're looking at a very, very stringent case. So first, I will look for a finer bound at I don't know 2/3 or something. Zero is way.
Oh, so the point is that you're not looking here for bounds and operators. The statement from here is that alphas equal to zero are not good in the field. This statement, it's not applying to the field. If you find a theory which has alpha zero, the tendency is that you need alpha zero, then you know this is not a good physical theory.
Right, but it's in my opinion, it's like saying, I just want to understand, right? So in my opinion, it's like saying, I should not allow negative number, but then give you a condition, I don't want numbers less than minus 10. So there's a whole series of basically pathological R charges that you're not
having. You don't allow anything which is negative, not positive.
Okay, so.
The modification of the rhombus where you sort of shift them like that, you said that corresponds to something in terms of our charge or a maximization. So there's some specific, you're saying there's some specific
choice of how you draw the rhombus.
Yeah, which is dictated by the R charge, the real R charge is what you got from a maximization.
Do you understand which one it is in terms of the?
We're trying to understand it, but but it doesn't have any simple geometrical picture. So, I mean, you have this cubic polynomial in angles.
Do you know actual solutions for at least some simple cases where you know the answer is anyway, and so you get more echoes?
Yeah, we got. I think, was it the epsilon 1 or the epsilon 2?
Which one?
Your student drew?
Yeah, there are figures for. There
yeah, but.
Figures with the right out charges for 100 pixels. But.
They didn't suggest
an example which will be useful is to take the conical and to demonstrate that the out charges are 1/2 for each. I think that would be useful for this question because then you can determine.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's say the conifold. We can also take F0.
Yes.
Where you have now this is a good example. I think F0. For F0, one of the faces has this brain timing. How do you do this isoradial embedding now? Because what you need to do, so you have these circles. Yeah, this is F0. And these circles must have the same radius. So from this, you see that there is some problem. If you want to shrink this circle to have the same size as this upper one, then you see that these four edges must shrink to zero size. So what does it mean? It means they have some corresponding rhombus, which I draw here, and if this rhombus shrinks, degenerates, then we see that this R charge, which is just this angle here, becomes pi, or over pi is just 1. And we know that in F0, these edges indeed have the unit R charges. So this is one example which, so this degeneration where you have unit R charges or the rhombus collapses this way is not bad. But if it collapses that way, so this way, where you have a long edge in the tiling, that's bad, that gives you zero R charge.
You can even say further, if you draw the grid of something which will have R charge equal to 1, and the rest, because we are dealing with squares, will have R charge equal to 1/2. Mm-hmm. Because of the relation that R charge is the theta angle divided by pi.
Okay, so this game was good for these R charges and to see what is this moduli space or the parameter space of a maximization you want to. So we have this manifold and you want to do a maximization over this. So what is this moduli space? You have these different rhombus loops all over in the tiling and you just count the number of them. And you can tilt this rhombus lattice along them and this will give you the dimension of the space over which you have to do a maximization. But this is not the most interesting thing.
So, without doing maximization, you already know that the left charge is 1.
Yeah. Because there are some... yeah, so here... there are some geometric constraints which... I mean, you can also, there is an overall rotation that doesn't count and so on.
So in general, the modular space is two-dimensional or more?
It's more. I mean, take a big orb before the conifold. Then you have many, many such Romulus loops, which will be basically also square lattice, and you can tilt along any of them. So, but the good observation comes here, I think, is that these rhombus loops, so these guys here, are in one-to-one correspondence. With these external PQ legs of the toric diagram. Okay, so why is this? I won't give you an answer today.
I'm not sure if people understand what.
Yeah, we will.
Rhombus loop.
This is the rhombus loop. Such a.
This is an inconsistent one. Can you show a consistent rhombus loop?
Yeah, here it is. It's not a loop, but you are on a torus, so sooner or later you get back to the same. To the same room. Here? Yeah, I need to draw more on back. Of course, this is not a rhombus, but we don't care. Okay, let's see here. You have also here you have a rhombus. So what is the rhombus loop here? Let's say you start with this rhombus here. And you go this way. And the next one will be this. And the next one will be this. And so on.
So you should have four total rhombus loops in that diagram because it's a.
That's right.
To the four side.
Well, that's right.
That's one of them. Where are the other three independent ones?
Well, you can start with this guy and you can go that way. And also you can start here and you can go that way or that way, for example, and so on. So you can count, and indeed this F0 gives you the right number of rhombus loops, which is 4, because we know that the toric diagram is just this. Moreover, yeah.
So you can argue that the number of loops is equal to the number of external legs.
I won't. This is an observation here. So, okay. So because we are on a torus, these loops that go sooner or later back to themselves, they have some non-trivial homology class, which is described by two integer numbers. So how many times are you crossing the boundary, this boundary and this boundary of the fundamental cell as you go around the loop? So for each rhombus loop, there is some number like P and Q. And there will be one PQ external leg in the toric diagram. Okay, so. One example, now I will show you a real example, which is SPP.
So, but is this the correspondence, is this an observation in the example, or is something?
Yeah, this is an observation coming from a lot of examples, but also I think we have some kind of argument that should be true, or some physical justification, but I don't want to talk about that. And also I would say it's unclear what is the relation of these rhombus loops to this process, this Castellani matrix. So you can compute the toric diagram in two ways. You can compute with this with this Kastrein matrix, and then you can compute the toric diagram, if you believe me, with these rhombus loops, which give you these legs, and then you just draw the perpendicular edges, which give you the toric diagram. So once you know these external legs, these arrows here, then you know the toric diagram.
So the rhombus loop give you the coordinates, the Q and Q coordinate for
Yeah,
each.
From the homology class, yeah. So, I mean, a priori, and this is also an observation, this is also an observation.
Do you have, what information in the rhombus loop is there exactly other than the topological, the intersection sort of information you have between the two? So that you...
This, yeah, only this.
So you would, for instance, be able to tell me, maybe not, so would you be able to tell me which loop corresponds to which external leg or
we'll see, let's see this SPP example and then...
Okay.
Of course, the toric diagram should be convex. And because we are dealing with affine spaces, so the ordering is not a problem. Okay, let's see an example, which is SPP.
You have to understand that this Kastrein matrix procedure produces the toric diagram in some sense.
Yeah, this might be equivalent to that.
Inside the period lattices of the target.
Okay. So SPP has three gauge groups, and the brain tiling is just this for SPP. I have to draw the fundamental cell, which is can be something like this. So the periodicity, this period lattice is this. Okay. Suspended pinch point. Okay. But I wanted to compute the toric diagram. But anyway, so the toric diagram is this guy. Toric diagram. Okay, so how do we count these rhombus loops? This is not trivial. So you have to do this isoradial embedding, then you draw these red lines. This is a mess, right? So what are these rhombus loops anyways? We have to identify them in the tiling directly. So let's get back to this example. Let's take this rhombus loop here, this one. Okay, so for each rhombus there is a bifundamental edge. So for this rhombus there is this guy. Should erase these angles. For the next rhombus here, there is this bifundamental in the tiling. Okay, then we get the next one and the next one. So we see that in the tiling for such a rhombus loop corresponds, there is a corresponding so-called zigzag, or zigzag path, or the zigzag loop, which is constructed from these edges here. So this has a special property, is that you start with this edge, and then you turn maximally to the right, to the left, which is this. Then you go to the next tiling node, and then you turn maximally to the right, here, and maximally to the left, and so on. So it's a zigzag, has a zigzag shape in the tiling. So for each rhombus loop, so the zigzags are just the same as the rhombus loops. For each rhombus loop in this rhombus lattice, we can identify such a zigzag path in the tiling. So we don't actually need to draw these blue circles and all these rhombi, which is a mess, a real mess, just too many lines on the, in the picture. We just need to count these zigzag paths in the tiling directly. So let's see. Let's start with this edge here. Okay, so go this way, we turn maximally to the left, this guy. We turn maximally to the right, this guy. And this edge is just the same as this one. So this will be our first zigzag path. So if we denote this direction.
So the zigzag path is a rhombus loop.
Yeah, that's just the same. If this is P, say, and this is Q, where we have these PQ homology classes, then this zigzag path will have a, what does it have? I guess a 1-0 homology. Okay, so we are not done. We have identified one zigzag path.
Why was a 1-0?
Because, so if you choose this to be the P axis and the Q, this is the Q, then it crosses this boundary once. So the homology is just, you're winding around the torus one time this way.
Oh.
This is the one, and zero times that way. This gives you this class, this two-dimensional vector. Okay, so we are not done. We find something similar here. So we start with this edge, and then we turn maximally to the left. We get that one. And maximally to the right. And we are back here again. So we see that there will be another one, another zigzag path with 1-0 homology. Okay. So it's getting complicated. How many zigzags are in the tiling? If you do an example on your own, then you will see that for each bifundamental, there is exactly two zigzags going through that bifundamental. So we use these lines, these edges once, so there will be another zigzag going through them. So I guess it would be this guy, for example. So let's see this example. I need more colors. So let's choose this edge here. Then we turn maximally to the right. Got that one. Maximally to the left. And then again to the right. And then to the left. And we are back to our starting point. Now, what homology does it have? It has it's a 0-1, probably. So they have some orientation depending on whether the black nodes are on their right side or on their left-hand side. So if the orientation is that, so that the black nodes are on the right-hand side, then these go that way, these yellow ones, and this goes, the blue one also goes that way. So these are correct. So if we have a zigzag, then the black nodes should be on the right-hand side, say, let's choose this convention, and then the zigzag has this direction, and not the opposite.
So you can do simple counting here, right? There are seven different fields. Each field has two zigzag paths, precisely two zigzag
paths. Yeah, but they are not different zigzags. So like this.
Yeah, but so altogether you have 14 times, 7 times 2. And so and you can add the length of zigzag path to get 14.
Right.
So the length of the first one was 2. Length of the second one was 2. And the length of the third one is 1, 2, 3, 4, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you want to sum all of the length of the path in order to get 14.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's 3, but
we shouldn't stop here.
Okay,
so what other zigzags are here? Yeah, let's let's use this guy here. So this edge, then you turn maximally to say to the right, this guy maximally to the left. And then you are back here. The direction should be this way then, because the blacks are on the right hand side. So this has a homology -1, 0. Okay. And I guess we have one more left, which should be
through the center.
Let's start with this one and turn that way.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so let's start with this one, this edge, turn to the right, that one, then to the left. And then what do we get? To the left, to the right. Yeah, I have to continue to the right, which is the same as here, and then to the left, which is the same again. So it goes this way, here, here, here. And this has, okay, now you you find the homology.
1, 1.
So the black nodes should be on the right hand side. So I guess that's the -1, -1. Because the black nodes should be on the right hand side always, otherwise you have the opposite homology.
And the counting of the number of peaks per how many peaks per each path?
Does this have two fields?
2, 4, 2, 4.
Okay, so let's actually draw this. Draw this. These guys. So 0, 1, -1, 0, just something like this, and -1, -1 is that way. So we have this set of vectors, and I order them so that they will give a convex. Convex shape, which is just a Turing diagram.
Is the fact that this particular polytope for this Torque diagram has one of its edges has it actually contains a lattice point, which normally screws things up.
Yeah. So here you have a lattice.
In terms of this.
Oh, yeah, it comes from just this from simple fact that you have two zigzags from the same with the same homology. So these two guys. So here these were these two parallel zigzags. This so you can transform.
I see an extra zigzag that you didn't draw. Maybe you can tell me why it's not there. If you do the yellow one that you just did.
This one?
The squiggly one.
Yeah.
And you go up, right, up, to the right, and then
here.
To the left. And then what if you go to the left?
You can't go. That's not a zigzag.
Oh, I see.
You have to go down to the right again. So, I mean, you can define any path you want, but these zigzags are special. They give you the toric diagram. So this is another way to count, to just to get to the toric diagram without actually computing the computation of the Castellan matrix and a determinant, which I can compute without a computer. This is much simpler for at least for small graphs.
So, is there, I mean, I don't see the justification why this works. Can you see how this works? Or is it just
can you? Even the equivalence of this Castellan matrix approach and this one is not clear. But so far, you know, they are in the same footage. They are only observations, but they work.
Maybe one thing is that if you draw, instead of drawing these different parts of the diagram, you draw the dual part of the quiver, yes. This will be VPS measures.
I see.
Okay, and so there will be gauge invariant operator, and there will be a one-to-one correspondence between the very big generators of the tire thing.
Right.
And so if you think about the external legs in terms of edges, corners of the toric pole, so the external two ends, you can think about them on the corners of the toric pole. And so there will be, for any corner, there will be one generator of the chiral ring, which corresponds exactly to the
new
lens.
Yeah.
And so this, in a sense, is just your real drawing, constructing the geometry using this, all these BPS operators.
Okay, let's...
So called extreme, in another context, you eventually construct and use construct some generalization of the suspended principle and what you was called the extreme VPS method, this process.
Okay, let's continue because I'm running short of time. So this approach has an advantage, is that this is invertible, whereas the Castellan matrix approach is not, because you're taking the determinant. So from, I don't know, in the next 2 minutes, probably I won't have time. Let's see. But I can tell you the basic idea that you start with a toric diagram. So this is now the inverse, where we are going to the tiling from the toric diagram. Now you draw these PQ legs, these external legs. So you know that there will be a corresponding zigzag or a corresponding rhombus loop. So what you do is the following. You draw your fundamental cell here, and then you start drawing these rhombus loops. These are just schematic lines. So this, for such a line here, there will be a corresponding rhombus loop. I'm just drawing them schematically, not drawing the actual rhombi. Okay, so this guy is for that one, because it has a 0 minus 1 homology. Okay, for this leg, we draw another rhombus loop. And for that guy, we have another one. So what you actually do, you will get a bunch of oriented loops here. You can shade them. Here these will be oriented. I don't have time to go through the details, but these will be, there will be a corresponding node in the tiling. You can check it. So there will be here, say, a black node, and all these other will correspond to a white node. So what do we get here if I double the cell? So this is now 2 times 2 fundamental cell. Just draw this again. Okay, this goes that way. this way and that way. So I'm shading these oriented areas. Here you have a white node. Let's say then this is a black node. You have a white here, black, the white here. This is also oriented, and a black. And then you, what you need is you just connect these guys along these intersection points, because you know that from an intersection of two rhombus loops you get a bifundamental. So here you see an intersection of these two red rhombus loops. There will be a corresponding bifundamental, which is this blue edge in the tiling. So then you connect these guys, and voila, you get the hexagonal tiling for C3. I don't have time for more examples, but fortunately I have one here. So this is, can you hand this to the other people? Thanks. So the example is just L152, what you see in the picture. And the corresponding fundamental cell, then I also doubled the fundamental cell to see the tiling. And then I redraw the tiling again and the quiver, which you can compute. And this L152 you can get from other, with other algorithms, and you get the same result. So it's promising. Okay, so I didn't have time for this. Just one more comment. What about cyber duality, right? Here you seem to get to one phase, which is somehow unique. Well, that's not true. You can move these rhombus loops around, and actually that corresponds to cyber duality. Okay, we cannot talk about this now. So, and I also not going to talk about in the remaining minus 2 minutes, but recent results that with the brain tiling, you can compute exceptional collections for the theory. So let's draw this here. So from the tiling, you can compute the toric diagram plus some exceptional collections. And with rigorous algorithms, from these exceptional collections, you can compute the quiver. This is rigorous. And from the tiling, you can also compute the quiver. And this can be shown that this is commutative, this diagram. So this is kind of a proof for brain tilings from last week. We still have some problems that to show that these collections are exceptional, but I think it can be shown. So thank you.
Is any of this technology restricted to space-time surface measurement?
I guess so.
N equals one. The fact that you are two-dimensional and the fact that you are on the toes. Actually, you can relax those conditions to something more, but it hasn't been studied in detail. So the toes is not that crucial, but being three-dimensional is crucial for having the
Any other questions? Okay, can go to lunch.